Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
When we live in a community, in a culture that more and more thumbs its nose at God and His commandments, that more and more mocks those who honor God and try to keep His commandments, that more and more glorifies the breaking of those commandments, can we be surprised when more and more of those commandments are broken and in more and more evil and horrific ways?
We really shouldn't be surprised at the increasing evil we see in the world today. As society has turned farther and farther away from God, the idea of a moral code has become to many a pointless endeavor. Pastor David shows us today how throughout history, those who chose to turn away from God also chose to let the enemy take over their way of thinking. So what can we do? We can pray continually. We can live lives so attached to God's heart that others won't be able to help but notice. Now, let's join Pastor David with today's edition of Enduring Word.
Open your Bible to Exodus chapter 20. We're in the midst of this great passage where God revealed what we call the Ten Commandments. In the Hebrew text, you can call it the Ten Words that were given by God to Israel, speaking audibly from Mount Sinai. Don't forget that. That as the presence of the Lord was manifest on Mount Sinai with a cloud and with fire and with earthquake and with thunder and with smoke and with a trumpet blast that sounded from heaven, God from heaven spoke these words to Israel. Verse 1, and God spoke all these words saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself the carved image of any likeness of anything that's in heaven above or on the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Honor your father and your mother that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox or his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. These words spoken by God to heaven came down not as the 10 suggestions, not as the 10 good ideas, not as the 10 voluntary initiatives, but the 10 commandments. God fully intended that Israel take these commandments and not only keep them for themselves, but to distribute them to all of humanity to be a guardrail, to be a mirror, and to be a guidebook for humanity. And yet when we come to the text here, we notice that these commandments are organized, you could say, into two groups. Therefore, we talk about the two tables of the law. The first table of the law contains the first four commandments, which have to do primarily with man's relationship to God. The second six commandments have to do primarily with man's relationship to man. And last week, we took a look at the first four commandments. Today, we're going to take a look at the next six commandments. So here we are, verse 12, the fifth commandment. Honor your father and your mother that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. It's simply said, isn't it? Verse 12, honor your father and your mother. Now this command is wise and it's good Because honor for parents is an essential building block for the stability and the health of all society. If younger generations are constantly at war with older generations, there's an unstable society that cannot last long. So we take it seriously. To honor our parents means to prize them. It means to care for them. It means to show respect and reverence to them. And the commandment is given to children, but it's not only for little children. It's for us who are adults as well. The commandment abides that we should honor our father and our mother. Now, the Bible teaches that there's many ways in which some kind of honor is due in human relationships. You see, there's honor due in relationships in the home. There's honor due in relationships in the community. There's honor due at the workplace. There's honor due between the citizen and the government and among people in the church. And all of those are important. But I'll tell you this, the foundation's here. If this one is destroyed, all the rest of them cannot last. If there's not a fundamental respect within the natural hierarchy that God has placed within the home, then everything else crumbles, and we need to respect this and give reverence to it. And I'll say this as well, blessings. Blessings to many of you who keep this commandment in exceedingly difficult circumstances. You're caring for an aged parent, and you're taxed by it. It stretches you to the extremity in a way that you never knew it would. God bless you for your love and your faithfulness. And I don't know anybody who endures that kind of long-term difficulty in caring for an aged parent, whoever feels that they did it perfectly, that they always responded with the grace and the goodness that they should. But I want to encourage you, and I want you to know that God looks down from heaven and he smiles upon it. That the sacrifice you make is pleasing unto the Lord. And even if nobody else understands and nobody else really gets it, how much you have to give, not just from your time and your body and maybe your money, but just from the emotions of your soul to care for your parent, God sees it from heaven and he honors you for it. Bless you for that. And then he says here that your days may be long upon the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You know, most pointedly, this had to do with Israel coming into Canaan. And I think what he's saying is this. If you guys don't have this fundamental honor between a child and their parent, your society won't last. I could give you the promised land. I could bring you into Canaan. But if you don't have this foundational building block, it won't last. Many people have paid the high price that rebellion and disrespect towards their parents has cost them. The next commandment, verse 13. Very simple. You shall not murder. You know, in the original Hebrew, it's only two words. Not murder. Don't do it. It's clear and to the point, but you should know this, that in the Hebrew as well as the English, there's a distinction made between killing and murder. In other words, not all killing is murder. Murder is the taking of life without legal justification. What would be the legal justification for killing? Well, execution after due process. Capital punishment would be included under this. Or moral justification. Moral justification would be self-defense. There is a such thing as killing that is not murder. You see, researchers tell us that there's seven words in Hebrew that one might use to translate the idea of killing. But this particular word is the one that implies premeditation. It implies intentionality. And this is a very important distinction. You know, those who take this command serious are often very concerned about life in the womb. They want to protect it. They want to preserve it. As much as they can, they'd like to see policies and ideas advance in our society that advance the protection of life in the womb. And sometimes people say, well, how could you possibly be pro-life, to put that tag on it? How could you be pro-life and also in favor of capital punishment? Ladies and gentlemen, this word clearly makes the distinction between killing and murder. And if capital punishment is carried out properly, it's quite within legal justification, doesn't violate this command at all. Now, I don't intend this morning to get into an extended discussion on capital punishment. I'd be delighted to discuss it with any of you more in depth. I mean, I think the Bible has a lot to say about it. All I want to make plain is this. This verse, Exodus chapter 20, verse 13, does not prohibit capital punishment in the slightest. It makes the clear distinction between killing and murder. Nevertheless, think how amazing it would be in the world today if this command were obeyed. What a difference. Think about how the blood of unresolved and unrequited murders cries out to the Lord from our own nation. You know, if this command were obeyed, life in the womb would be protected. If this command were obeyed, senseless murders wouldn't horrify the nation. When we live in a community, in a culture that more and more thumbs its nose at God and His commandments, that more and more mocks those who honor God and try to keep His commandments, that more and more glorifies the breaking of those commandments, can we be surprised when more and more of those commandments are broken and more evil and horrific ways? You know, we've talked about it several times. I hope the image is in your mind that the law is like a guardrail for society. It keeps us on the road. And what we've done in a somewhat systematic fashion in our community, in our larger culture over the past many years, is we've knocked down the guardrails. You don't need the Ten Commandments. You don't need a God-based morality. You don't need God at all. The Ten Commandments shouldn't have anything to do with public life or morality or anything. Get them out of the way. What, then we're going to act like we're shocked when things like this happen? Ladies and gentlemen, this is just the trend. It can be no other until there's more and more of a turning to the Lord God. That's the only answer for these things. Yet, there are many people, when they see some infamous evil that's spread abroad in the press, that's on the cable channels, you know, 24 hours. When something like that comes, it really makes people face difficult questions. They ask like this, well, where is God in the midst of this? Now, I understand the heart behind that question. It's someone who's reaching out to God in the midst of tragedy and sorrow. But nobody should think for a moment that God is somehow to blame for this, as if God was sleeping on the watch. God's been there all along. It's the culture that's thumbed their nose at Him. And then they turn around and say, where was God? I'll tell you where God was. God was given the Ten Commandments. We were the ones not listening to them. But know this as well. Nobody should think that our Christian faith is some kind of sanitized faith that can't stand the dirt and the evil and the tragedy and the sorrow of this fallen world. I'll tell you something. Christianity was born into a world that knew evil and tragedy and sorrow on a scale that we can hardly imagine in our own culture. Now, we rightly grieve and our hearts go out for the tragic death of some 30 people in Connecticut. And it's terrible. It's an evil tragedy. But I think of something that happened not far from Nazareth, where Jesus of Nazareth grew up. When Jesus was about 11 years old, there was a widespread rebellion against the Roman government centered in Galilee. And the rebels took control of a city named Sepphoris. It was only 4 miles from Nazareth, a very short distance from Jesus's house of residence. And in Sepphoris, when they launched this rebellion against the Roman government, the Roman legions responded and they crushed it. And when they crushed it, not only did they level the city of Sepphoris, not only did they kill so many innocents in overwhelming the city, not only did they take every surviving woman and child and sell them into cruel slavery, but they took 2,000 men from Sepphoris, some of them guilty, some of them innocent. They took 2,000 men from the city of Sepphoris and they crucified them all along the roads in the area. There's an 11-year-old boy, Jesus, walking down the road and he sees hundreds of men hanging on crosses. He sees murder and injustice and evil on a scale that we would regard as almost unimaginable. And he realizes that God has given him the place to come in and to redeem society and to redeem men and women, to change a culture by changing individual lives, by bringing godly influence, by transforming things. And are we not the inheritors of this? And so we bless the name of the Lord, but we realize as people ask these dangerous or these despairing, I should say, they're not dangerous questions, they're despairing questions. Where is God in the midst of it? I'll tell you what we say. We answer back without hesitation. We say that Jesus is the answer. Jesus Christ brings comfort and peace in the most impossible circumstances. I'll say this as well. Jesus is the answer in another sense. He's the answer in the sense that he will judge the guilty and they will answer to him for their crimes against his little ones. Make no mistake about it. Some people may think that in some case like this, where some evil man goes and he murders a bunch of people and then turns the weapon of his destruction upon himself so that he can be held to account in no human court of law, that somehow he's escaped justice, not for a moment. He hasn't escaped it at all, but rather he's been put into the hands of the ultimate judge, Jesus Christ himself. Jesus is the answer as well, because when his love and his word are received and spread abroad in a society, such things don't happen, or they don't happen with nearly the frequency. And Jesus is the answer, because if our society rejects him more and more, don't pretend to be shocked at the results. Most importantly, Jesus is the answer to transform your heart and your life. Maybe there are some people here you have at some point in your life, you have in some way or another, you have violated this command in your action. I would say there's probably almost every person in this room, we have violated it in spirit. Because did not Jesus speak to us very directly and say that this commandment prohibits not only the action of murder, but the heart of murder, the heart of hatred and indifference? The heart that would leave people to their own destruction. The heart that would condemn people to a hell if it could do it. No, Jesus told us, this commandment tells us not only not to murder, but also not to hate. We look at this and we go, Lord, I'm a commandment breaker. Verse 14. You shall not commit adultery. Boy, it's simply said, isn't it? Right there, I look at it and it's just five words. You shall not commit adultery. And clearly here, the act itself is condemned. God allows no justification for the ways that we creatively justify the breaking of our marital commitments. It's not to be done. And when it is done, it's sin. And you know what else it does? It damages. It's not a victimless crime. It damages. Now, the Bible does make the distinction between, for example, in the Mosaic law, the punishment for adultery and the penalty for extramarital sexual relationships. They're different sins, but they're related. Here, most specifically, is the violation against the marital bond. You shall not commit adultery. And again, I'd just like you to consider for a moment, think of what it would be like if this command would be obeyed. What a different world it would be. Think of how many attorneys would be out of business if this command were obeyed. Now, if you look at this and you say, well, I haven't obeyed this commandment, you can repent. You can call it for what it is. It must be just by the law of averages that I'm speaking to people right now. And you're in an adulterous relationship, or you're on your way to one. If we were to sit down and discuss it over a cup of coffee, and you tried to justify the reasons why, maybe it would fall into two categories. Maybe some of you, it's frivolous, it's a curiosity, it means nothing, you're just hyped up with lust and with foolishness. Let's just call it's just foolish. You're being foolish. And could I just say, you're being foolish? Don't be foolish. Don't go on this path to your own destruction. Think of how much you have to lose. Don't be a fool. You think you can justify it in the name of novelty or curiosity or nobody will find out or I won't get caught. Don't be a fool. Then I think there's another group that you would talk to them about them and they would say, no, I'm not being foolish. I love that person. You see, honestly, I just don't love my own spouse much anymore. That love seems to have gone cold. It's mundane. I don't want it anymore. But I want what I seem to have with this new person. There's a spark there. There's something amazing. And do you know what I would say to that person? I would say it as gently as I could, but I say it as firmly as necessary. I'd try to look him in the eye and I'd say, Jesus called you to lay aside lesser loves for his glory. I can't try to debate whether or not you really love that person, but I will tell you this, that if you'll obey Jesus, if you'll do what he said and lay down before him the things that dominate your heart and let him really be the Lord of your life in this area, God will bless you for it and God will honor you for it. You're on a path that will not lead to good, but only to error. And then we think about it, we think, wow, the New Testament spoke of this, Jesus did in the Sermon on the Mount, not only in the act itself, but also in the heart that desired the act. And then we say, we're all covenant breakers. We're all guilty under this covenant. The New Testament puts it this way. It says in Galatians chapter 5, now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, licentiousness. That pretty much covers it. That God has given a beautiful plan for the power and the greatness of sexual relationship, for it to be the power and the bonding force, or at least one of them, that bonds together this beautiful one flesh relationship that God intends in marriage. And when you take that power, when you take that force and put it outside of the bounds of marriage, it wreaks more destruction than anything else. So we say, God, here we are, covenant breakers, would you please come and speak to our hearts. Verse 15, the eighth commandment. You shall not steal. You know what I find so amazing about these commandments? If we come back to that picture of a guardrail and just think, honor your father and mother, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal. These are absolute foundational building blocks for a healthy society. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a command that's extremely important to say you shall not steal because it basically lays out the right to personal property. It says that God has entrusted certain things to certain people, and if I take it as if it's mine, that's stealing. It's not mine. It's yours. So it belongs to you. If you give it to me, fine, but if I take it without permission, that's theft. Why is it theft? Because it belongs to you and not to me under God's ordinance. Don't steal. Think about how great it would be if this command were obeyed. Think about living in a community, once again, where you didn't have to lock your front door. Live in a community where you could park on the street, run into the store, and you leave your keys in the car. It's just no big deal. You don't have to worry about it. Oh, what a wonderful thing that would be. But I want you to think about this in another term. You see, we can also steal from God. Now, how do we steal from God? Well, of course, there's one sense in which we steal from God, and when we refuse to honor him with our financial resources.
Thanks so much for joining us today for this edition of Enduring Word Radio. Over the years in Christian media, we've seen all sorts of misrepresentations about supporting ministries. Everything from give your last dollar to if you don't give, God's work won't be done. These sorts of manipulations are not biblical, and they do not represent God's heart for giving. Here at Enduring Word Radio, we want to run fast and far from these sorts of misrepresentations. That said, it's also important for us to be faithful to share with you the ongoing financial needs that we do have. Enduring Word Radio is heard all over the United States. The program that you listen to today was professionally produced, and purchasing time on some radio stations comes with a cost. So we want to be sure to at least inform you and ask that you seek the Lord about supporting Enduring Word Radio. There's a secure option to give right on the homepage of enduringword.com. You can give a one-time gift or partner with us on a monthly basis. Again, that secure option to support Enduring Word Radio is available at enduringword.com. In closing, our thoughts on ministry is where God guides, God provides. God is faithful, and He will continue to provide for Enduring Word Radio. Again, thanks so much for joining us today for Enduring Word Radio with Pastor David Guzik. It's our hope and prayer that today's message has been a blessing to you. Until next time, may God bless you and keep you.